I really view it as a starting point for a species that really hasn't been given the attention it probably deserved for the past 20 years.
The Fish and Wildlife Service has a new population count for Pacific walrus. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 30th of December. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, weighing the pros and cons of North America's other big gas pipeline project.
We can protect this land until hell freezes over, but if we do not have an economic base, our people will perish.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Attention hunters, you must apply now for all drawing hunts and for all Tier 1 and Tier 2 hunts in 2010 and in 2011. There is no application period in the spring of 2010. Be sure to tell hunters they can apply online until December 31st. Information online at wildlife.alaska.gov or 1-907-267-2257. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is out with an updated count for Pacific walrus. The agency estimates that there are a minimum of 129,000 animals in the population, but says the new number can't be compared to past counts. The massive undertaking was a collaboration between the U.S. and Russia. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The survey took nearly a decade to finish and included intricate techniques that had never been used to count walruses before. Dr. Susan Speckman is a wildlife biologist at the agency who helped lead the study. She says it feels great to have the count complete.
It's turned out to be a much longer and much more complicated process than any of us had thought when we first, began. And so we are very happy to have it behind us.
The last Pacific walrus count occurred in 1990. Biologists estimated there were about 200,000 animals at the time, but they say the new and old numbers aren't comparable because the counting techniques were so different. Human observers used to count the animals from airplanes. This time, the agency developed a thermal imager that could spot warm walruses against their icy backdrop. It scanned sections of the ocean several miles wide from a plane that flew at 21,000 feet. Biologist Doug Byrne helped develop the technique.
And not only did it cover that large area, but it was very reliable when it would detect the walrus by their body heat. And it was also an unbiased estimate of how many walrus were in the group. Earlier studies had shown that different observers would sometimes overestimate or underestimate the number of walrus in the group, particularly large groups, are very difficult to accurately estimate.
The new number isn't as precise as biologists were hoping. It has a large margin of error, partly because weather prevented surveys in some of the walrus's range. But the actual number biologists came up with may not be as important as what they learned about the animals along the way. Dr. Speckman says that was one of the great successes of the project.
This really brings walruses kind of back on the radar, if you will. So Fish and Wildlife Service is now more focused on walruses. There are environmental issues going on now that's bringing a lot more attention to walruses. And so I don't view this as an ending point. I really view it as a starting point for a species that really hasn't been given the attention it probably deserved for the past 20 years.
One of the most interesting things biologists learned is how much time walruses spend in the water. For the first time, the survey accounts for the animals that aren't resting on the ice floes at any given time. Biologists put satellite tags on walruses to determine how much time the animals are typically swimming. Dr. Speckman says the data was eye-opening.
The model showed that they spend approximately 83% of their time in the water. And I was impressed with that. I really thought they spent more time out of the water than that. But interestingly enough, I had the opportunity to travel to Gamble and Savunga on St. Lawrence Island and present some of our results to the people who hunt walruses. And they weren't surprised by those numbers at all. That was pretty much right in the neighborhood of what they would have expected.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering whether to list walrus under the Endangered Species Act because their sea ice habitat is disappearing. The Center for Biological Diversity sued for the review. Rebecca Noblin is a staff attorney with the group. She says she's disappointed the current walrus count isn't more accurate, but she says an exact number isn't necessary to determine the health of the species.
Even without a really accurate count, I think the science is pretty clear that the sea ice is melting and they are losing their habitat. So even without knowing exactly how many walrus there are, it's pretty clear that they're in trouble.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will release its decision on whether to list the walrus next fall. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Canadian government is due to release a long-awaited report on the Mackenzie Valley Natural Gas Pipeline Plan. The Joint Review Panel's report is expected to be a very detailed examination of the 760-mile pipeline's prospects and environmental impacts. The permitting process for the pipeline has been repeatedly delayed, and the national political climate in Canada has been turbulent. Canada's Conservative government was almost toppled a year ago, and today Prime Minister Stephen Harper called off next month's session of the Parliament until after the Vancouver Olympics. The Joint Review Panel began writing its report in 2004. It was initially supposed to take just 10 months to complete. ExxonMobil subsidiary Imperial Oil is heading up the coalition that wants to build the Mackenzie Pipeline, which would deliver gas to a hub in Alberta, just as the proposed Alaska gas line would do. Imperial has managed to negotiate terms with most, but not all, of the native tribes whose lands the pipeline would cross. From Yellowknife, Canada, the CBC's Lee Selleck reports that the First Nations are looking forward to the government report.
From the start, emotion and bureaucracy mingled in the Joint Review Panel hearings on the Mackenzie Gas Project. Mayor Peter Clarkson opened the hearings in Inuvik.
We might love the land a little bit more than we love Imperial, but...
We can protect this land till hell freezes over, but if we do not have an economic base, our people will perish.
Fred Carmichael, then president of the Gwich'in Tribal Council, showed early support for the project. Today, four of the five key Aboriginal governments have signed impact and benefit agreements, but not the Detcho First Nations. Keenan Norwegian was chief in Fort Simpson in 2006.
I'm sitting here like I was in a court system trying to defend myself and my people's rights to their lands.
But the Liberal government of the day backed the project, and the Conservatives followed suit. Even so, the federal government hasn't cut a special deal yet with Imperial Oil and its partners. Pius Rollheiser speaks for Imperial.
Those discussions are ongoing and they're confidential. The dialogue is continuing, and we're pleased with the progress we've been making.
The Joint Review Panel's report will be handed over to the National Energy Board. By September, it plans to decide if the project can go ahead, and if so, on what terms. Rollheiser says Imperial still has high hopes.
The Mackenzie project represents a significant, vital new source of gas that the North American market needs and will need in future.
Lee Selleck, CBC News, Yellowknife.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sitka takes steps to healthier living.
Their meals now have whole wheat. Whole grains, and they no longer have iceberg lettuce, they have romaine lettuce, so they've made some changes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Find qualified Alaskans to fill your company's job vacancies at Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. Alexis has hundreds of workers for you to browse through, and you can specify details about required levels of experience and other qualifications. Learn more at alexsys.alaska.gov or visit any Alaska job center. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Alaska's minimum wage goes up 50 cents on New Year's Day to $7.75 an hour. This is the second increase since state lawmakers approved the raise in April. In July, the minimum wage went up 10 cents to match the federal rate. The increase is the first since 2003, when Alaska's minimum wage jumped $1.50 to $7.15 an hour. 5 years later, that was worth about $6.22 an hour, considering inflation. State economist Brian Ray says even at the new rate, the real earning power is quite a bit less than $7.50.
Now, with the increase in the minimum wage July 1st, and now with the January 1st, 2010 increase, that comparable earning power is about $6.65 an hour compared to 2003 minimum wage of $7.15 an hour.
While higher pay is good news for Alaska workers, many of whom are employed in retail trade, hotel, and food services, Ray says it's hard to quantify the impact the increase will have on Alaska's economy.
We believe that as wages go up, that employers may look for other ways to either substitute machinery for workers, so therefore the demand for workers may go down. An employer may decide not to bring on a new worker because they don't think that they can make enough profits. But we really have no way to try to weigh the pros and cons of an increase in the minimum wage and quantify it.
With the January 1st increase, Alaska will join 14 other states that have a minimum wage higher than the federal hourly wage. Five states still have no basic minimum hourly wage. American Indians and Alaska Natives are much more likely to die from the H1N1 flu than other populations. The Centers for Disease Control showed the increased risk in a report earlier this month. Dr. Tom Hennessy is director of the CDC's Arctic Investigations Program in Anchorage. He told APRN's Lori Townsend the data confirmed suspicions about the effect of H1N1 on Native groups.
We know that historically for pneumonia and influenza deaths lumped together that American Indians and Alaska Natives have a higher rate of death, and that's just from past years. We knew that. And then there was a report that was done by 12 states that looked at deaths due to pandemic H1N1 flu and found that for American Indians and Alaska Natives living in those states, which was about 50% of the American Indian population, that the risk of death from H1N1 flu was four times greater for American Indians than compared with all the other racial or ethnic populations.
There are 12 states and three other countries involved in this study. Did the rates vary noticeably between states or countries, or were the higher rates similar percentages when you looked at the native populations in those areas?
There was some variability across the states, but the trends tended to stay the same throughout all of those states. And some of the states, like for Alaska, for example, there were 10 deaths reported in Alaska, and I think only two of those were American Indian or Alaska Native, which is pretty similar to the proportion of the population that is in that racial group. But I think basically, for all the other states, there was a tendency towards higher risk among American Indians.
How do the rates of vaccination in Native communities and the states and countries that you looked at compare to the general population? Is that known?
That isn't known. I think we have a good idea about how much vaccine has been distributed through the Indian Health Service system or in the United States. And I think that those facts are probably known for the Canadian populations as well. But in terms of actual percentage of the population vaccinated, that's a harder one to get at. It's easier to measure doses that go out. It's a little harder to get a denominator onto that and to know what percentage of the population has been reached. We're working towards that. There's an active effort to collect that information so we understand how well the vaccine reached those communities, but we just don't have a firm answer yet.
And Dr. Hennessy, why do you think this is happening?
Well, that's an important question and one we'd like to know more about. When we think about risk of death from influenza, there's really a number of things that could lead to that. One could be that we've noticed across all of the studies that have evaluated people who've died from pandemic flu, it's quite obvious that the people who die are frequently those with other underlying medical conditions. And we know that for some kinds of conditions like diabetes and asthma, those are a higher prevalence among American Indians and Alaska Natives than the general population, and that those may contribute to the increased risk. There's some other suspicions, though, that we have that there may be other factors. And this is harder to tease out, but we know that for other respiratory infectious diseases, household crowding is very important because the more people you put in an environment, the more transmission you have, so the greater likelihood of coming down with flu in a given environment. We also know that for Alaska, for example, their respiratory infection risk is associated with not having in-home running water. And that may be a concern, although one that we can't put our finger on with this particular study. Then there's some other issues. For many of the American Indian and Alaska Native populations, they live in very remote communities where access to definitive care is harder to get. I think there's some strong consideration for doing follow-on studies to try to tease out these more specific risk factors so we can better understand them. Because I think buried in all of this may be some things that we can learn about prevention of influenza that may help communities that are disproportionately affected.
The 1918 flu pandemic hit Alaska Native communities very hard. Does this study further confirm that H1N1 is related to the 1918 virus?
I can't really answer the specifics about relatedness, but I think in terms of what we're seeing in impact in tribal communities, there's some similarities. In Alaska in particular, there were some, you know, just terrible stories about what happened to communities and villages hit by influenza. We haven't seen anything like that during this pandemic, and we're fortunate and glad because of that. But we are aware of the history and the history of past pandemics, and that they have had a disproportionate impact on tribal communities. And that's really led us to have this increased effort and focus on American Indian and Alaska Native tribal communities to make sure we can do everything we can possible to alleviate pain and suffering and to prevent illness. I think one of the lingering questions is whether there's some increased aspect of vulnerability, and I think the future evaluations of what risk factors led people to get ill and or die may help us tease some of that out and do a better job in prevention in future years.
Dr. Tom Hennessy is director of the CDC's Arctic Investigations Program. He spoke with APRN's Lori Townsend.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority is hoping to secure $73.5 million in federal stimulus funds for new infrastructure at the Ketchikan shipyard. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, Alaska Ship and Dry Dock says the money should be enough to fully implement its development plan.
ADA, which owns the Ketchikan shipyard, filed the grant application this fall. Doug Ward is the director of shipyard development for Alaska Ship and Dry Dock, which operates the shipyard. He says the $73.5 million grant would provide the funding to construct a grounding grid at Dry Dock Number 2, build another open berth, and expand the shipyard's production facilities.
Future improvements is going to add additional production to support more repair work going on and really give this shipyard, which is on a very small footprint, characteristic of a lot of northern European shipyards, a lot of capability to a lot of diverse kinds of work down there. And that's what is one of the keys to sustainability in our industry today.
Ward says the state likely won't hear if it was awarded the federal grant until this spring. The proposed grant funding would be on top of $50 million in federal earmarks approved for the shipyard in 2005. That money was used to build a land-level berth and a second dry dock, which combined cost a total of $17 million to complete.
Those two elements, the land-level berth and floating dry dock number 2, comprise what we call a ship transfer system that gets new ships from on land and into water, or ships repair out of the water and into land.
The federal money appropriated in 2005 will also go towards constructing two ship assembly halls. Ward says the enclosed buildings will allow the shipyard to better compete in the international market for shipbuilding contracts.
In Europe, for many, many years, in Northern Europe, that has similar climate conditions that we have, they've been enclosing their shipbuilding processes for a long time. More recently, even in the Gulf Coast, you'll see more and more enclosed manufacturing facilities in shipyards for things like temperature control and accuracy control and things. Even in warm climate, being indoors enhances or makes production more efficient.
Ward says the previous funding and the grant money ADA applied for this year should be enough to complete development of the shipyard. He says the infrastructure would allow the shipyard to increase the number of ships it can repair annually and expand the shipyard's shipbuilding capacity.
Back in the early 80s, shipbuilding wasn't anticipated to be as an important part of the business as it is for us today, but it is an important part of our current economics for having a sustainable shipyard down there.
ASD has operated the shipyard since 1994. Ward says the company has averaged approximately $19 million in gross revenue over the past 10 years. This year, he says the company's gross revenue should top $30 million. That's significantly higher than ASD's first year of operation, in which it grossed $2.4 million. The shipyard currently employs 177 workers. Ford expects that number to grow to 350 full-time year-round workers once the shipyard is fully developed. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
A five-year program to develop healthy habits in Southeast Alaska has come to a conclusion. Steps to a Healthier Southeast Alaska ran from 2004 until just this last week, when the federal grant funding it ran out. The grants manager and other health officials in Sitka say the program made a difference. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
Grace Brooks managed the $3.8 million federal grant, which stretched over 5 years. The goal was to reduce diabetes, asthma, and obesity. That's a pretty tall order. Brooks says they started with the basics, education and awareness.
We'd be giving out samples of healthy snacks at the grocery store and just building awareness through that. We did PSAs, enhanced PSAs, and just got people thinking about awareness. And then we took it to the next level of doing community planning. So we did the Sitka Health Summit here. The first one was 4 years ago, almost 4 years ago.
Out of those meetings came ideas, such as making Sitka a bicycle-friendly community and starting a community garden and a farmer's market. Brooks says Sitka was ready to embrace many of the concepts that came out of the meetings. And she says, so were other cities.
We did a community planning in Wrangell. And that community really jumped on it. They did incredible things. I mean, they have a meal program in their schools now, which they've never had. And they have a breakfast and a lunch. They formed a Healthy Wrangell Coalition, and they've extended the hours at the rec center so the community has more opportunity for recreation. So, you know, I think Sitka had a readiness, but I think other communities really are ready if somebody is there to help facilitate and give them an opportunity.
Schools across the region looked at themselves and figured out the ways they were promoting health and the ways they could be better at it.
Certainly one of the things that came up with Sitka was more better lunches. And so they did improve their meals now, have whole wheat, whole grains, and they no longer have iceberg lettuce. They have romaine lettuce. So they've made some changes. And a lot of schools did that, kind of looked at their structure and then saw, and some of them even found that they needed employee wellness. They needed some things for the teachers to help support them.
Promoting employee wellness is becoming more prevalent among health insurers who see it as a cost-saving measure. Spending money on helping people develop better habits could keep insurers from having to pay for costly doctor visits later when things go wrong. You've heard of employers worrying about absenteeism? Brooks says they're also worried about something called presenteeism.
So somebody who is at work, but really they're not. Their mind's not there. They're not really paying attention. So they're really not productive. where if you have healthy employees and provide that opportunity for them, then chances are there's not going to be as much presenteeism and the workforce is going to be more productive.
The STEPS grant was administered through search, but other health providers also played a role in its implementation. Jennifer Spriggle is case manager of health promotion and disease management for Sitka Community Hospital. She says the grant helped work toward not just promoting better health, but also toward the more elusive goal of helping people change the way they think about health.
It's hard to roll a snowball back uphill. It's kind of, you know, if you can get that visual. And our traditional medicine in our society has been, when it breaks, fix it.
Under the old model, you got a disease and you went to the doctor. Spriggle says as automation took over a lot of our physical tasks, humans became more sedentary and a whole new realm of health concerns popped up.
The automation and the eating of this and that and the processed foods and things getting more instant and available took its toll on our physical bodies because we were never designed to operate that way. But hindsight's always 20/20. So you go through all this stuff and then you look back and you're like, oh, wow, should have not done that.
The point, Spriggle says, is that to promote healthier habits, you can't just look at someone, say, you need to do this and this and this and this, and then expect them to get better. You have to understand their readiness to change.
I mean, you can have a plethora or like a smorgasbord of all these unhealthy habits or things that you engage in. And there may be one of those that you're willing to make a change in.
The STEPS grant made a huge difference in helping Sitkins move toward healthier lifestyles, Spriggle says. And she says while the STEPS program is done, it's important to note that the work can continue. In fact, both Spriggle and Brooks say that's especially important to keep in mind this time of year when people often resolve to make changes. This is Ed Ronco reporting in Sitka.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, and Lee Selleck with CBC in Yellowknife. APRN's Lori Townsend reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com. And by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN.